This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Failure is discouraging. It can be difficult to stay positive after an unsuccessful attempt to change your career, your habits, your life. And our culture doesn't always encourage those who've made missteps to bounce back. Megan McArdle knows this all too well, having been let go from a series of jobs in a variety of fields. But after she landed her dream job as a journalist, she began to appreciate her litany of failed ventures. She used her journey to examine the merits of risk and failure in her book, The Upside of Down: Why Failing is the Key to Success. She joined Marty in 2014 to discuss her experiences, as well as the laws and legislation that either hamper or harness the power of going out on a limb. Let's listen.
I have been laid off and fired, not as often as you have, Megan McArdle, but I have to say it's always, there's a sense of humiliation, even if it's not your fault, so to speak. And a sense of self-doubt that can easily set in. Did you experience some of that?
Oh God, absolutely. And you know, I did not want to say in this book, like, failure is awesome, you're just gonna love it. You don't. It feels terrible.
No, not at all.
Because it's supposed to feel terrible. If it didn't feel bad, you wouldn't stop doing whatever it is that's not working. But yeah, no, even if it's not your fault, you feel ashamed, you feel so anxious about what the future is gonna be because you don't know. Actually, if you look at studies of happiness, it's about the worst thing that can happen to you in a modern society, except for death or dismemberment. It's really terrible, and it makes you very unhappy. But there is a little bit of an upside to that, which is that what I realized when I took that job at The Economist, you know, it paid a third of what that management consulting firm job had paid. And I had $1,000 a month in student loan payments to make because I had close to six figures of student loan debt from business school. And if I hadn't been at the point where I felt like, I just give up, right? I can't get a job doing a business school thing. Would I have dared to take the risk to pursue this amazing job that has led to this amazing career that I love? I'm so happy when I wake up and I'm ready to go to work every day. I don't think I would have. Freedom really can be another word for nothing left to lose. And you do have to go through that of really sort of looking into yourself and dealing with it. The good news is at the end of it, you probably worry a little bit more about getting laid off than a person who hasn't been through it. But you also, when it happens, you think, oh, yeah, done this. We can do this again.
There's this concept called grit. There's someone in Philadelphia that got actually one of those genius awards.
Yes.
With this idea of what grit is, which in my mind is a kind of stick-to-itiveness, a resilience, the willingness to do hard work in the face of the possibility of failure.
It's really difficult. And I start about talking about fixed versus a growth mindset. And, you know, fixed people, when they confront a challenge, they think, this is going to be a dipstick of my innate level of talent and ability. And it's going to be a measurement, and either I'm going to measure up or I'm not. And growth people think of a challenge as like, hey, maybe I will be terrible at this, but that's how I'm going to learn. And they do better and they improve more because they take on more challenges. I'm a complete fixed mindset person.
I am.
Oh, gosh. Writers tend to be. It's why we all procrastinate so fiercely. We're so afraid of finding out that, like, we've lost our ability to write or we never really were as good as we thought. As long as you haven't written it, it's still good.
Of course.
So I was talking to the psychologist who pioneered this, a woman named Carol Dweck, and I said, I've got to confess, I'm really a fixed mindset person. She said, oh, me too. But the thing is, you can change. And she said, you know, I knew I was changing the first time I heard myself say, oh, wow, I really suck at this. This is really fun. But she said it took a long time. And that's what I was surprised in the course of writing, because I'd already knew that a little bit. I had already accepted that in order to write a feature or whatever, I was going to have to accept that I can rewrite garbage, but I can't rewrite nothing. But you can change how you think about it merely by understanding that this is true, merely by understanding that, like, everyone fears failure. Most people are afraid of finding out they don't measure up, and that what's actually true about doing challenges is not that it's a measurement, but that it's the way that your brain grows, and that if you take them on, you will at the end have learned a lot. It's a difficult psychological shift, but I find myself making it in the course of writing this book. And so, you know, the good news about all of this is that most people are afraid to do this, but they can actually change it.
Well, and you also talk about the fact that many people, and I would include myself in this, feel like imposters, you know, that we're just going to be, it's just a matter of time before we're going to be found out. We go through our paces, you know, try to do a good job, but there's a part of us that feels like we're really not up to the task.
Oh, yeah. No, my especially common among successful women. is that they're just convinced that they're about to be unmasked at any moment as the frauds they are. And I remember when I got into Penn, which is where I went to school, right. So I'm glad to be back in Philadelphia, I was convinced that there was some girl out there named Megan McCandle who had been unfairly denied her admissions.
The difference between an N and an R, right?
Yeah, basically, just made a hideous mistake, and I told my parents this, and they still laugh over it. But it really, it's very common. And the problem with this is that you actually handicap yourself. It's not even that you just don't try things, which is part of it. But there's this phenomenon called self handicapping, where you'll actually put yourself in a situation where you're almost destined to fail, because then you will feel like you haven't really tried. And so they gave people this impossible test and then told some of them they'd done well on it. And they said, now you can take another test like that again tomorrow. Do you want this performance-inhibiting drug or a performance-enhancing drug? Surprising number of people chose the performance-inhibiting drug. Why? Because then they had an excuse. And we do that to ourselves all the time. We're afraid of being unmasked, and so we play it safe. We hunker down, and we don't do anything that might unmask that, you know, this image we've been projecting to the world of being successful is all a fraud. And the fact is, look, if you're in a position where you're a great NPR host or a columnist or whatever, it's unlikely that your bosses have just somehow failed to notice that you don't perform, right? I mean, or that no one, that secretly everyone hates you, or that secretly you're not really that smart. But it's really, really common to feel that way.
Well, what's interesting, and I'm thinking in terms of even bankruptcy laws, which allows people to, in a sense, start over again. And on the one hand, you could see how that would help someone who really does have a good idea and will put that idea to work, and someone who really is going to fail again. You can see how it could work both ways.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And one of the, I guess, most surprising parts of this book to most people is my passionate defense of easy bankruptcy, which I think is like the hidden strength of the U.S. economy that no one ever talks about. But the fact is, it's true. You can free people who are not responsible and who are just going to do something crazy and try to start a jackalope ranch to go try to fail again. You can also free people who are abusing the system, and some people do. Some people strategically run up debt and knowing that they're going to declare bankruptcy, or they spend wildly irresponsibly knowing that they're going to declare bankruptcy. When you actually drill down into these cases, the abuse isn't that common. The number of people who actually declare bankruptcy is much smaller. It is a fraction of the number of people who could benefit from bankruptcy. Most people struggle on with their debt as long as they can. When they give up, it's because they're really at the end of their rope. And I think that's actually a good compromise, is that because our laws are easy, we have some social stigma against it, and that means people struggle on as long as they can, and that allows us to keep the laws easy. It allows us to say, it's really surprising. You go into bankruptcy court and you're expecting like weeping mothers and so forth. And it's like traffic court. It's like nothing. It's just some lawyers stand up and say, my client doesn't have any money. And the judge is like, okay, well,
sign this piece of paper.
Yeah, sign this piece of paper. Debt's discharged. It's completely undramatic. And that's a great thing. But people don't, it's not even because people don't know that. It's just that most people would rather not declare bankruptcy if they can possibly avoid it. And so they don't. And yes, there are the people who go on. But, you know, success is not as easy to predict as you think. If you look at entrepreneurs who have started a company and failed and try again, something under a third of those people will succeed again. Right? Like, I think it's about 20% of those people will succeed the second time. But if you take people who succeeded and you give them funding and so forth, it's only 30%. It's actually most people, even people who were successful in the past, they can't do it again a second time, because there's this element of you're doing something that you've never done before, that no one's ever done before, which means definitionally you don't have enough information to know whether it's going to succeed or not.
Kind of like a batting average. I mean, a good batter mostly strikes out, right?
A successful, I love this analogy, and it's completely on. A great batter is a guy who fails 7 out of 10 times he steps up to the plate. And a great entrepreneur is a guy who fails 7 out of 10 times that he steps up to the plate. Yes, you're going to have some failures the second time around, but not necessarily because you've freed someone who's stupid or takes too many risks, but just because, you know, entrepreneurship is risky. But it's also the engine of our economy.
You mentioned comparing the prison system in Europe and in the United States. And you write about an interesting program called the HOPE program as a way perhaps of taking some of these principles and ideas we've been talking about and applying them to people on probation or trying to get out of prison, trying to get back on the or trying to get onto the straight and narrow.
Yes, I spend most of the book arguing that we should depersonalize, that failure is an inevitable consequence of even taking smart risks, and that therefore we should spend as little as time trying to blame people and we should be as forgiving as possible. However, I didn't want to say, well, all failures are just no one ever does anything wrong. Like Bernie Madoff wasn't an accident.
Right.
I wanted to look at something where, what do you do when people have actually done something wrong? And I'd gone into this thinking, because I'm basically libertarian on drugs, that this was going to be a lot of nonviolent drug offenders. And it wasn't. It was a lot of assaults and robberies and so forth, things that we all pretty much agree are not okay. But what's interesting is these people get put on probation, and normally what happens in probation is that it's like a suspended sentence. There's a prison term hanging over your head, and if you violate too many times, you're going to go back to prison. It's true of parole as well, slightly different, but basically similar. And what happens is people violate all the time. They miss appointments with their probation officers. They test dirty for drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And a shocking number, I think it was well in the 75% range of people were actively using drugs at the time that they were brought into court. And a lot of these crimes were committed under the influence, including alcohol, by the way, not just illegal drugs. Over and over and over again, they do this. They've been caught hanging out with people they're not supposed to hang out with, and nothing happens except the probation officer yells at them. And then eventually, 10, 20 times later, they get fed up and say, okay, look, you can't be on probation. You're not keeping the terms. I'm going to the judge and getting you sent to prison. And the judge looks at this and says, well, you want me to send this guy to prison because he missed a probation appointment? And so often won't, because it's each individual infraction is small. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, about 50% of the people flunk out of probation. So what they did was said, instead of this, which public policy professor Mark Kleiman calls nothing, 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 bam, 5 years in prison. They looked at it the way a parent does. And parents know this, right, is you can't just punish your kid 1 in 10 times. But most of the people in the prison system did not get that kind of parenting, either because their parents were working and not there, or because their parents had some sort of issue like abuse, drug use, et cetera. You know, one defense attorney I talked to said, look, every one of my clients in the juvenile system has either one parent, no parents, or is being terribly abused. And so what they get is not that punishment is consistent. It's that punishment happens when mom's in a bad mood and happens to be around. And so they feel the same way about the probation officers. Why did you get sent to prison? Well, I guess she must have been in a bad mood. Not, I guess I must have used drugs 1 too many times after I was told that this was the condition of my probation. So instead, what they said is, every time you violate, every time you don't show up for a probation appointment, unless you were in the hospital or dead, you were going to jail. But you're only going for a few days. Oh. And because of that, because they get sent every single time, they connect, oh, every time I do this, this happens. And they've cut the number of people who go to prison in half. And it's one of those few policy things where it's really win-win-win.
That was Marty's 2014 interview with journalist Megan McArdle about her book, The Upside of Down. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from the stars and author of the jazz opera Yardbird. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscoane. The famed Apollo Theater, that make-or-break venue famous for its unforgiving crowds, just staged its first ever opera. It's called Yardbird, based on the life of jazz musician Charlie Parker, who himself played and recorded at the influential Apollo. The performance is part of a new collaboration between the historic Harlem Theater and Opera Philadelphia. Yardbird had its premiere in Philly, so we thought we'd invite some of the folks involved to talk about the show and the process of staging bebopera. Marty was joined by tenor Lawrence Brownlee, who plays Parker, soprano Angela Brown, and librettist Bridget Wimberly. Let's take a listen.
How did you prepare for this role of Charlie Parker?
How did I prepare? This has been a learning process for me. I won't call myself a jazz aficionado, but listening to the music of Charlie Parker and some of the other jazz greats during that period in time where bebop was being developed was good for me. I do a style, as you said, bel canto, which is a very florid style of music. And as we know, that jazz also is very, I guess we can call it florid, but virtuosic, a lot of fast-moving notes. And so since I do that style of bel canto and trying to pair that with jazz, it seemed to work well.
Did you spend a lot of time learning about Charlie Parker's life? Was that important for you?
I did. You know, I did a lot of reading, and of course, YouTube is good for that. And I think it was Bridget told me to look at the book about Stanley Crouch, you know, who wrote some things about wrote a book about Charlie Parker. And so the research that I did to try to get something about his life and what he went through during that period of time, and just to kind of get a background story. Of course, we know that his music speaks for itself, but a lot of people don't know about the life of Charlie Parker, and I wanted to research that so I could be better informed.
To you, Angela Brown, you play Charlie Parker's mother, Addie,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And you're quite a presence on the stage, I have to say. I saw the performance on Sunday afternoon. How did you prepare for her role? And this is her son who suffers, who has his demons, who makes mistakes.
Exactly. You know, I was telling this story a few days ago that I think I've been playing a mama since I was six.
My part mother of your said, nature?
Yeah, it's part of my nature. You know, once they put those sensible shoes on and that lightweight blue dress with the little white collar, I look like my paternal grandmother. And I said, okay, here we go. But I also did a little research on the background of Addie, and I could just feel her, how she felt. What I read was like a stream of consciousness. You know, she was being interviewed because Bridget gave me this research, and she was being interviewed about her child, and whatever came up came out. So whether it wasn't in a chronological order, and I just felt that she had this energy about her that she was very protective. She wanted to take care of her son, but she had to let him live, you know, and make his own mistakes. So in preparing for this role, like I said, I think I've been preparing since I was six.
Yeah.
But she's a mama. She's a mama. And I have a lot of great mothers, including my own, to draw from.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Bridget. You set this in the couple of days after Charlie Parker's death. So he's kind of in a limbo world. No one has claimed his body. So something lives on. What was your thinking?
Well, my thinking was what it might feel like for all of us at that point of after your life is over. What happens? And if you get another opportunity to fix the things you want to fix or the things that you wanted to do that you didn't do, on stage, you can explore that. And opera just seemed like the perfect place to do it because it's different than theater in a lot of ways. So that was the jumping off point.
Well, I do want to play another piece from this opera, Charlie Parker's Yardbird. This is a piece called Just As Birds Trying to Fly. And this is Charlie Parker struggling to write this piece of music. Let's just give it a listen and then we can talk. Lawrence, you're on the stage really the entire time. I think there might be one little moment where you're not there. How do you prepare, or how are you, or did you, are you preparing for this performance? Are there certain things you do?
Well, I have to pace myself. It's exhausting being
Is
on
it?
Stage. You know, there are a lot of roles that I do where I'm on stage a fair amount, but I have a 2-minute, 3-minute, sometimes 10-minute break from being on stage, and I could run to the restroom or get some water or just sit down. But, you know, I just kind of, in the staging, I get a chance to sit down for a fair amount, so I'm not on my feet per se. But it's just trying to live in the story that I am constantly engaged, so I don't think about the fact that I'm on stage, but just trying to live through all the emotions, and there are many that we go through in the role of Charlie Parker. So I take it easy the day of the show and just try to, you know, gear myself up to mm-hmm. be on stage and be involved in what's happening.
How about for you, Angela? I do want to play a piece of you singing, but I'm just curious about the kind of prep that you do.
Well, I much like Mr. Brownlee here, I rest that particular day, make sure I take all my vitamins and everything, drink lots of water.
How much water?
I drink maybe a half a gallon because I don't want to drink too much because then I'll have to jump in and out that costume all the time during the show. And it's not a lot of time because this is only a 90-minute program, you know. And I think I have the most costume changes because I'm actually the person that shows the passage of time, you know, within the show. But and I, of course, warm up and, you know, relax and do some exercise and just prepare, get ready to be mama.
Well, we're going to play another clip. And I have to say, this is the audio from the video that was taken of this opera. And it starts, "Ain't easy. It ain't easy to be a mother of a black child, man child all alone." So you're really singing about what it was like to be Charlie, or what it is like to be Charlie Parker's mother.
Exactly. What it's like to be, probably with everything that's going on in this world, any mama of a black child right now. It's just, you're just scared about everything. And she was scared about everything, especially his different appetites that he had. So,
well, let's give it a listen and then we'll talk some more. Another clip, and just to read what those lyrics say, and then I'll turn to you, Bridget. "Ain't easy, it ain't easy to be a mother to a black man child all alone. This land ain't no place for a black man child got dreams. You keep telling him, no, no, can't go there. No, no, you can't live there. No, no, you can't sit here, can't work there, can't date her. Hell no." Pretty powerful lyrics.
Well, thank you.
I mean, are you talking about the 30s or are you talking about now or both?
I think it's since slavery ended, you know, to the present in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. There's been certainly a lot of advances, but there's still, you know, the lines you can't cross. And sometimes it seems, mm-hmm. sounds like 2015.
Well, you kind of reference that as well, Angela, sort of
definitely.
Feeling as if these are words that have meaning today.
They definitely have meaning today. But with Addie Parker, you know, the reality was if you did those things, harm would come to you. You know, going places, sitting down in the wrong place, working in the wrong place, dating the wrong color person. Definitely, mm-hmm. it got you lynched in Kansas City at that time. And probably anywhere in the United States.
Well, he liked white women. I mean, you know, we see that.
Well, he had two black wives and two white wives. So he was an equal opportunity lover. Yes.
What were his demons? I mean, he clearly had demons and heroin, of course, one of them.
Yes. When you think about people think about his addictions. I think that's the first thing. Well, probably his music. And then secondly, I think would be his addictions. Yeah, he had demons. I'm sure that it didn't sit well with him that he left his wife and his child. And of course, the way that Ron, the stage director, put that in the show, he's looking at the baby, but we've made a conscious choice not to go close to the baby because I think that there's a barrier there. I think his addictions help him to deal with that. Right after that, we bring the symbol of his addiction, Moose the Mooch, into the opera.
In a wheelchair.
Up. And so, yes, the fact that he left his mama, he's an only child, to a mother who did everything for him because of her guilt probably that she felt because he had a father who wasn't present. So he left his mom in Kansas City along with his wife and his child. He went to, when they talk about his horn in the second act, there's a lot of things that he said. You know, he betrayed many people, but he betrayed even his love for his horn and other things too. I think this is a person who constantly is fighting a lot of things in his life. And of course the time dealing, you know, with the fact that racism was very much alive and well, and he just survived, I think, because a lot was going on in his head.
And the phrase you use for the heroine, I mean, it's horse or tar horse. I was interested in the tar horse, Bridget.
Well, that was the terminology of the time. So I tried not to make up anything other than the fact that he's living while he's dead.
Not easy to do, right?
Small detail.
But I read everything and had to read it multiple times in different sources before I committed to it. So I just wanted to be as authentic as I could to Charlie Parker's actual journey and the relationships that he had, which were important. The women in his life, I could see where they served a very important relationship that kept him going forward. They were all different, and they supplied different functions at different times in his career. So with Doris, he seemed to be the most successful during that time period. She was very organized. She kept his life in order. Chan was fun and loving and a good time, and he had a good time with her.
Do you think, to you, Angela, do you think Charlie Parker's mother loved him too much?
Well, I guess you can't have too much love, but it may have been in the way she loved him. Kind of excusing some of the things and only excusing it to the public. Now, she could see it and she would tell him about himself, but, you know, kind of keep that at home. Mm-hmm. Don't, you know, share that with everybody. So she was definitely... She protected him to others. You know, she took up for him. But she was very well aware, and she always told him, son, you got to get it together. You have to.
Both of you, you scat in this. Is that part of your repertoire?
No, not necessarily. I come from a background of singing gospel.
Right.
And, of course, I sing bel canto music, which is very florid music. So my voice does move. But I've been telling people all along that I didn't necessarily have a scat language. And so that's something that I'm trying to develop with all deference to the great scatters of this, you know, the world. Two of my favorite singers in the world are, well, they're deceased now, but Ella Fitzgerald and Mel Torme.
Oh, my goodness.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been listening to them quite a bit. And so in the opera, I don't get a chance to do a lot of scat, but there are about three or four places where I get to do exposed lines that are, I think Daniel took some direct transcriptions of some of the virtuosic scats that Charlie Parker played. And so I'm trying to...
Is it known for note, or do you get to kind of
it
improv
is pretty
a little
mu-
bit?
It is pretty much. But the bida, buda, ada, Billy Dalton, that stuff is stuff I've had to make up. So that's me developing my scat language.
You scat too, don't you?
Child. That was a surprise to me. It was funny.
Oh, was it?
Because I saw this music and I was like, Daniel, who did you think? You didn't listen to me, did you, brother? You didn't know you. I was like, no, my voice doesn't do this. But I had to imagine it. So it was funny. I think finally at the dress rehearsal, I just said, well, And I'd been talking to your cover, Joshua Stewart, and he said, just be free with it. You know, don't try to make it something that makes sense. Let it only make sense to you. And so I closed my eyes and I pretended I was playing a saxophone as if, you know, he got this wonderful gift from his mother. And since the whole song was about saxophone, you know, he's the king of sax. And so I just closed my eyes and did it, whatever, you know, and it worked. And I was like, thank you, Jesus. That was the angels coming down to scat job. I had nothing to do with it.
Surprise your own self.
Then. I did. I said, oh, that was good. Told you.
There are times, though, when you feel like the music is sort of operating at one level, and as the singers, you're operating at another level. I mean, it does have that sort of, it's opera, but it has that feel of jazz.
Jazz, and I think a little bit of musical theater from time.
Oh, interesting.
Especially in Addie's part. Because it stretches the outer parts of our voices as well as the inner. And you just have to draw on everything you ever learn. Just like Larry said, he has a strong background in gospel. I have that as well, but mine is also musical theater. Yeah. So I had to bring in some of that kind of belty kind of thing, but on high belt, high healthy belt, to make it more earthy, grounded. Addie is the grounding to this show. She's tethered very well.
That was Marty's interview with the stars and author of Charlie Parker's Yardbird, recorded last year. The Bebopera made its way to the Apollo Theater. When we get back from the break, we'll get Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy's take on affirmative action. Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. The Supreme Court will soon be revisiting Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin, which has the potential to change the country's official position on what's known as affirmative action. The controversial practice is an attempt to correct racial disparities in college admissions, with opponents claiming it's a violation of equal protection under the 14th Amendment. Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy is a proponent of affirmative action and discussed its merit and the ways in which colleges, workplaces, and the government already take race into consideration in an unofficial capacity. He joined Marty in 2013 to discuss his views, outlined in his book For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Let's listen.
Help us understand, and I think because it's such a misunderstood word, and I always hate to begin an interview with a definition, but when you talk about affirmative action, how do you define it?
I'm talking about any policy that prefers people associated with a given group. I'm talking about racial affirmative action, but, you know, there's affirmative action comes in all sorts of guises. There's gender affirmative action. We have affirmative action for veterans in many states. So anytime that a private entity or a government reaches out a helping hand to try to advance the fortunes of a given group, that's where you have affirmative action.
And in the case of racial affirmative action, to right the wrongs of what? Discrimination, of racial inequality.
Well, affirmative action is justified along a lot of different with respect to a lot of different rationales. So one rationale for justifying affirmative action is to try to rectify the mistreatment of the past. So past mistreatment has left scars that continue to debilitate people. And so one rationale for affirmative action is to help people along who have been hurt bypass discrimination. Another rationale for affirmative action is to just speed the integration of society. So just suppose there are people, for instance, who've immigrated to the United States recently. They haven't been victims of past discrimination, but you might think that unless special efforts are made to bring them to the table, they'll be left on the outside. So integration can be a justification for affirmative action. Or a justification that people talk a lot about now with respect to higher education, diversity. The idea being that in order to have good decision-making, in order to have a rich intellectual environment, you need to have people from all sectors of society involved so that people can learn from one another's different experiences, different perspectives.
It has been described, and I think largely by critics, as a quota system, that it's the creation of, you know, we want these people in our university, in our business, because we need to satisfy some kind of a quota system.
Well, people often use quota as a scare word to make affirmative action seem rigid, to make it seem rather wooden. The fact of the matter is we do have certain quotas. So here's one of my favorite quotas. Ever since the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, there's always been at least one black person in a presidential cabinet. I don't think that's accidental. And that's true, too, with respect to presidents who said that they were against affirmative action. Ronald Reagan said he was against affirmative action, but Ronald Reagan always had at least one black person in the cabinet. George Bush said he was against affirmative action, but he always had one black person in the cabinet. As far as I'm concerned, a quota doesn't necessarily have to be bad. I would like to know more about it. I think that you can have intelligent quotas. I think you can have stupid quotas. I think you can have intelligent affirmative action. I think you can have stupid affirmative action.
You begin the book talking a bit about your own life and acknowledging the fact that you feel that you have been a beneficiary of affirmative action policies, whether it was going to St. Albans, a prep school, going to Princeton University, getting into Yale Law School.
Yes, I am an affirmative action baby. And I was a little bit worried about beginning the book on an autobiographical basis, but I thought that it would be important to put a face on affirmative action. And one of the reasons why I think it's important to do that is because affirmative action has been so vilified, it's been so stigmatized, that even some people who have been beneficiaries and like affirmative action get real defensive about it because they feel that their achievements are being somehow downgraded. If people say, well, you know, were you benefited by affirmative action? I think some people feel it to be almost an insult to be asked. So I thought, well, I have been benefited. There is no question but that I've been benefited. I'm a professor at Harvard Law School. I've been at Harvard Law School for 29 years. I was asked to come forward and put myself forward as a candidate to be a professor at Harvard Law School.
They sought you out.
They sought me out. That's very unusual. I was a good law student. I went to Yale Law School. I was a good law student, very good law student. Nonetheless, very unusual for an institution like Harvard to seek somebody out. Why was I sought out? I was sought out in large part because of the affirmative action ethos. They wanted to change the complexion of their faculty, and they took special steps to do that.
Well, one of the people that has criticized affirmative action is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, talking about the shame of affirmative action, feeling that it's damaging and dangerous, and feeling, it's as I read what he has said about it, is it somehow questions his credentials or puts his credentials in question.
Yes. Justice Thomas is the most vociferous critic of racial affirmative action on the Supreme Court. And he has said many times, that he feels that his own accomplishments have been degraded because people assume that he has been a beneficiary of affirmative action. The fact of the matter is he has been a beneficiary of affirmative action. There's nobody in the United States who's been more of a beneficiary of affirmative action than Clarence Thomas. He does have a point, by the way.
I'm sure some people feel that way about him.
There is no doubt that there are people who feel that way. And there is, in my mind, there's no doubt that this is a cost of affirmative action. I think it's rather unavoidable. I'm sure that it affects me. When I begin my contracts class at Harvard Law School, I'm sure that there's some students in the audience. I have a class of 80 wonderful students. I'm sure on that very first day that there are some students who are thinking to themselves, who do I have before me? Do I have a real Harvard Law School professor before me? Or do I have a somewhat lesser affirmative action Harvard Law School professor before me? Well, that's a cost. And that's not the only cost that comes with affirmative action. There are others. But you always have to ask, you know, compared to what? Mm-hmm. In my view, the benefits of affirmative action far outweigh the cost.
Well, in fact, you even write in this book that you have seen students, probably in your classes at Harvard, that you feel are unprepared and perhaps are these affirmative action students that were brought into this elite university.
I think, well, first of all, at my law school and at many places, there is affirmative action. And sometimes you can have a situation in which you over-promote people. So, for instance, now in the affirmative action debate, there's a lot of talk about what some people call mismatch. Some critics of affirmative action say that in attempting to help, some students are over-promoted. They're admitted to institutions in which they will do poorly. And the argument is, if you didn't have affirmative action, these students would have gone to places more fitting with their preparation, instead of going to the prestigious place where they're at the bottom of the class. They would have gone to a less prestigious place, but they would have been in the middle or maybe even at the top of the class. And in my view, affirmative action is like any other policy. We have to be careful. We have to be experimental. We have to be empirical. We have to see what's working, what's not. And if there is way over promotion, if people are being put into places where they're going to fail, well, no, that's not a good thing. But in my experience, that is not the way it's generally panned out. In my experience, institutions have been thoughtful. In my experience, affirmative action has been a useful way of desegregating elite institutions in America.
One of the critiques has been that affirmative action has been largely helpful to white women and to middle-class African Americans. It has helped a certain subset of the population, probably those that had some of the requisite skills that you need to make it at an elite university, for instance.
Yes, and that's especially if we're talking about higher education. That's true. So, I mean, if you're talking about affirmative action for a law school, affirmative action for a medical school, the people who are going to be beneficiaries are, of course, going to be in the sort of upper sectors of the population. I mean, if you're a beneficiary of affirmative action for law school, that means that you're a college graduate. You're doing pretty well. And there's some people who say, why should we be allocating attention to those folks instead of allocating attention to, let's say, the kid who doesn't graduate from high school or who graduates from high school but is still functionally illiterate? In my view, we have all sorts of problems in America. We need to be addressing inequity along a wide range of avenues. But we still have to be attentive to elite institutions. One point.
Go ahead.
The Supreme Court of the United States. Supreme Court of the United States, very powerful institution in American life. 9 people on the Supreme Court of the United States. All 9 went to 2 law schools. All 9 members of the Supreme Court of the United States went to either Harvard Law School or Yale Law School. That is, it seems to me, a vivid illustration of the importance of elite institutions. And it indicates why we have to be attentive to continuing to desegregate these institutions.
When you talk about, I guess, good discrimination, and that, of course, you know, taps into a whole host of issues, the idea that you can discriminate against people for, I guess, the greater good of the country or to redress inequities or the horribleness of the past. But I think for the individual person that feels that they are being discriminated against, who said, look, I didn't own slaves, I didn't live in this country in the 19th mm-hmm. century. I wasn't part of Jim Crow. Why should I sort of bear the brunt of this country's past?
Yeah, this is what I say to the person who claims, the white person, let's say, who does not get into, let's say, the University of Texas and says, gosh, my record was better than this other person, a black person, who did get in. I'm the victim, the white person says, of reverse discrimination. What do I say to that person? I say, listen, number one, can white people be discriminated against? Answer, yes. So if you show me a situation in which a school has excluded you or otherwise discriminated against you in order to put you down, in order to show that it thinks that you're inferior, in order to, if it's expressing racial animus against you, if it's doing anything against you because of your race, I'm against that. And I think that you have a good claim of reverse discrimination. That is not what is going on, however, in our institutions of higher education across the United States now. White people are not being excluded, are not being discriminated against because somebody's trying to put down white people. After all, in the last case, Fisher versus the University of Texas,
right.
Most of the students at the University of Texas are white. It is completely implausible to think that this predominantly white institution is excluding white people in order to put them down. What's happening is that white people are they being disadvantaged to some degree? Yeah, they are being disadvantaged to some degree. But the question is, why is their opportunity being limited to some small degree? It's being limited to some small degree for a purpose. What is that purpose? That purpose is to reach a helping hand out to racial minorities that for a long time have been oppressed in America. Now,
well, let me just stop you there, only because, again, in this perhaps even going back to the Texas case or to cases of individuals, which is, yeah, absolutely discrimination of the past, slavery, Jim Crow. I mean, it's a long, long
and list. By the way, let me just break in, not just, because I don't want to overemphasize, what? Not just discrimination in the past. The fact of the matter is there is discrimination going on right now. We all know it. There is an invisible wind that faces people of color, and another justification of affirmative action is to counter that ongoing racial discrimination.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to get to, which is, I mean, I think it's perhaps harder to prove that kind of discrimination because in many ways it has gone underground. You could mm-hmm. prove it when there were the poll taxes, for instance, but is it harder to prove the kind of discrimination that exists today and that makes it difficult to argue for affirmative action?
Well, two things. Number one, anybody who takes a realistic view of America knows that there's racial discrimination in every aspect of American life. People do tests all the time, audits all the time that show the presence of discrimination. Furthermore, with respect to every index of well-being in American life, it's quite clear that people of color get the shorter end of the stick, whether we're talking about employment, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about the administration of criminal justice. A lot has changed in America, but the fact of the matter is the race line is still there. And my argument is, in order to deal with the race line, in order to continue our advance toward racial decency in America, we must continue to be race conscious.
That was Marty's 2013 interview with Harvard Law professor Randall Kennedy about his book, For Discrimination. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.